We are going to begin today our study in Pilgrim's Progress, and of course, we will, as I said, God willing, move from the Pilgrim's Progress on to Holy War and look at some of Bunyan's writings. I, unlike my predecessor, who had meticulous notes. Did I say meticulous? I didn't say tedious, did I? No. Okay. I had meticulous notes. I don't. And but I am so excited about looking at Bunyan and at Pilgrim's Progress. And so, in a general way, just to introduce, I did talk with you last week about some of the books, some of the things that are available. I encouraged you to buy a copy of Pilgrim's Progress, whatever that copy may be, that it would be a copy that you intend to have for your very own personal Pilgrim's Progress for the rest of your life. Just like a Bible, I mean, Pilgrim's Progress is of such a caliber that you need a copy that's just your own, just like your Bible, and you just keep it forever. I've suggested the one that was done that has the explanatory notes by Thomas Scott and an introductory bio of Bunyan by Josiah Condor. This book has been published by different publishers. I don't know how many different publishers. I don't think it's... did we find out that it is in print now? Fresh, new? It's not. It's been out of print for quite a while, right? But there are still copies of it available online. I encourage you to find one and buy it. You will pay anywhere from $45, $50 and upwards for a copy of this. But it is one that you can keep forever. And I will quote my predecessor who said that if you don't have a Pilgrim's Progress with Scott's notes, you don't have a Pilgrim's Progress. I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, that's just what he said. And it sounded pretty profound. I thought I'd quote it. But anyway, it definitely is worth the value. And also, we are going to, companion with that, I mentioned it last week, I'll mention it again, Alexander White did a series of lectures in the 1800s on the characters from Bunyan's writings, all of them, Pilgrim's Progress, Holy War, and all. And they were published in they were called Series 1, First Series, Second Series, Third Series. Series, First and Second Series covers Pilgrim's Progress, all of those characters. As third series covers Holy War, and there is a fourth series, and I have not yet found it, a copy or anything. These are available and can be had, and I showed you there is actually a company redoing these in facsimile reproductions, and they can be bought brand new. I showed you two last week. We have actually one available, belongs to the church. Someone wants to buy it or just use it. But anyway, I am taking the time to read, as we go through Pilgrim's Progress, I'm studying White's compilation of these characters as well, so that we have the advantage of all that White had to say. As well as that, I do want to begin, there is no way to begin to study any of Bunyan's writings without having some bio of Bunyan himself. To understand his works is to understand the man, is to understand his works. And so it is very important that we know. And I hope, children, you will be reading Bunyan's writings for the rest of your life. You'll be reading Pilgrim's Progress, Holy War, in different versions, in different forms for the rest of your life. So this is very important for you to know. It doesn't have to be, I don't have to advertise to you how very valuable Bunyan's writings are. To this day, as best I could find, I did try to do some research. As far as I know, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is still, to this day, the second most printed book in the English language. Still to this day. It is shocking that Americans, by and large, have almost no knowledge or interest in Pilgrim's Progress. Because, as I say, it says volumes that it is still, even now, the second highest volume English language book printed in the world. That says a great deal. And so I do want to do some bio of the man Bunyan. When we get to the Pilgrim's Progress, we will be reading it more or less together, along with comments and our interaction and our sharing together. But leading into that, since I did so highly recommend finding a volume like this that has Josiah Conder's biography and Thomas Scott's notes, I wanted to give you some brief bio of those two gentlemen so that you know exactly who it is that you're talking about. And today, I'm not going to, obviously, not gonna get very far in this. We will move more quickly later. But I wanted to go ahead and share with you in this volume the biography that I will be taking. And many men have done a bio of Bunyan. Probably this one by Josiah Conder is probably still the best that's ever been done, and it was done in 1838. The bio that's in the front of this book was written and published originally in 1838 by Josiah Conder, who was a prominent London Congregationalist. He was a very prominent abolitionist, by the way. He was the fourth son of a very active nonconformist in the city of London, and his father was an engraver and a bookseller. And Josiah Conder was born on 17th of September 1789 at his father's bookshop in Falcon Street in London. And his grandfather was Dr. John Conder, a dissenting minister and president of the Homertown College, and his uncle was James Conder, the famous coin collector. So, in his infancy, he lost vision in one of his eyes, and because of by smallpox. And then he was sent a few miles north of London in the village of Hackney for electric treatment. You know what that was? They would actually hook wires up to you and shock you. In those days, they thought that was a medical treatment. Josiah Conder was sent up north for electric treatment that they believed would stop the spread of that disease, and because of the electric treatment, he lost the sight in his other eye. But the good news is he recovered, and he continued to be educated at a dissenting academy in Hackney Village under the tutorship of a Mr. Palmer. When he was 10 years of age, his first essay was published. 10 years of age, he had his first work published in the Monthly Prospector, and when he was 15, he began work assisting his father in his city bookshop where he'd been born. On reaching the age of 21 in 1811, he took over the family business. And a short time later, he married Joan Elizabeth Thomas, one of his friends back in his literary associations. And he worked at the workshop until 1819. And then his literary talents were offered. Because of his literary talents, he was offered the editorship of the Eclectic Review, which was a prestigious literary journal, and he continued to edit that for 20 years. He was a strong Congregationalist, and of course, as I said, he wrote much against, he was an abolitionist, against slavery. His Congregational hymn book sold some 90,000 copies in the first year, 7 years of its publication. So he was quite a writer. And as I say, he wrote this bio introducing Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. He wrote that and published that in 1838. He also wrote some very famous hymns that we use. Bread of Heaven, On Thee We Feed, Thou Art the Everlasting Word, and the one that I truly love, 'Tis Not That I Did Choose Thee. For, Lord, that could not be. This heart would still refuse Thee, hadst Thou not chosen me. Thou from the sin which stained me hast cleansed and set me free. Of old Thou hast ordained me that I should live to Thee, to Thee. 'Twas sovereign mercy found me and taught my opening mind. The world had else enthralled me to heavenly glories blind. My heart owns none before Thee, for Thy rich grace I thirst. This knowing, if I love Thee, Thou must have loved me first. Josiah Conder wrote that. This is the man who wrote the introduction to the bio in the front of Pilgrim's Progress that we will be reading. I couldn't leave this out, a little bit of interesting history. Josiah Conder had a wife, and heaven forbid that we leave the women out. And she took a leading role in the abolition of slavery in the United States. December 1852, along with a number of other British women. She was part of a group of ladies who met at Stafford House on Friday the 26th of December to consider the expediency of addressing a memorial from the women of England to the women of the United States on the subject of slavery. My goodness, I can imagine that was a formidable force to be met with there. He died, Josiah Conder died December the 27th, 1855, at St. John's Wood, Hempstead, following an attack of jaundice, and he's buried in the Congregationalist Non-Denominational Garden Cemetery there at that church. His literary wife, Joan, died at age 91 in 1877 and is buried with him in the family plot. He left five children. Now listen to this. He left five children, one of whom is a daughter, four sons. One of the sons became a civil engineer and a railroad contractor. Another, Reverend Eustace R. Conder, became pastor of a Congregationalist church at Poole. Mr. Jonan Conder was of the Bank of England. And Mr. Charles Conder was associated in professional pursuits with his eldest brother. So the family stayed very much together and very much in the work of the Lord as their father had set the example before them. And, if you care, that's what he looked like. Not altogether handsome, but pretty impressive fellow. That was Josiah Conder. That's who wrote the bio in the front of our copy of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Then Thomas Scott, who wrote all of the notes, commentary, if you please, a commentary on Pilgrim's Progress. Reverend Thomas Scott was an influential preacher and author. He was born in 1747 in Lincolnshire. He was the son of a grazier. Don't you like the way the British can make things sound so big? He was a farmer. He was the son of a grazier, and he was the 10th of 13 children. Boy, thank God his mother didn't stop at 9, because he wrote a tremendous commentary on Pilgrim's Progress. The 10th of 13 children. His mother, hate to read this, but I have to. His mother was better educated than his father. And she taught Thomas to read. And he went to various small local private schools before he was sent at the age of 10 off to Richmondshire, 150 miles away from home at the age of 10. Sent 150 miles away from home to go to school. He returned in 1762 and he was apprenticed at 15 years of age to a surgeon in Alford. But he was soon dismissed for bad conduct. So he returned to his family farm in disgrace, reduced to a working laborer for his father. And he endured this for 10 years before he finally left home in 1772 and became an ordained Anglican minister at the age of 25. He was afterwards admitted into the ministry for a more comfortable career, didn't believe in most of the doctrines that they preached, and so he became a dissenter, and he broke his ties with them. Of course, he had a wife, he married in 1790. She passed away, and he remarried in 1791, and he had two daughters and three sons, and all three of his sons followed him in the Anglican ministry. What a testimony. What a testimony of faithfulness in these men. And it was Thomas Scott who later wrote the notes of commentary that are to be found in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. That is Thomas Scott. Finally, and very quickly, Alexander White, whom I said to you, wrote the compiled an analysis of all the characters of Bunyan, separate, put them under separate covers, to pull those characters out and studied them individually, is what he does. Alexander White was, as I said to you last week, a hard-headed Scottishman. he was a Scottish divine indeed. He wrote the set, of course this is a much more recent printing that I have here, but he wrote this four-volume set between 1893 and 1908. And by the way, he wrote, let's put that in its context, Alexander White, the Scottish divine, wrote these commentaries, these analyses of Bunyan's characters between 1893 and 1908. That was 205 years after Bunyan was dead, but 119 years ago. So there's a lot of time here, and just so you understand. But I thought this was an interesting note. Someone said of this gentleman, I like him, said his appearance in the pulpit was as arresting and impressive as the preaching itself, which attracted people of every class and kind. A deep appreciation of God's grace to save sinners gave him rare passion and power. A dramatic quality captivated his congregation with his depth and spiritual fervor. And someone said this, quote, "To know Dr. White was to know what the Covenanters were like in their most splendid hour." What a testimony. What a testimony indeed. And there he is, Alexander White. So, I wanted you just to have some brief survey of the people whose works we are using, and you can look those up for yourself, of course, and pursue looking into their lives as you will. Very quickly, because I want to get to a single thought today, and that is it for today. The biography of Bunyan himself, the man Bunyan. He lived, of course, during the reign of the Stuarts, which was a horrible time for those who wanted to use the Bible and not be a part of the state church. And so he wound up spending, in all, 12 years. We'll look at that in a little bit more detail, not today, but later. But he spent in all, total, a prison, 12 years in prison for no other crimes than his insistence on having the Bible to be the sole guide for his life. We don't appreciate the blessing of liberty that we have. Bunyan spent a total of 12 years in a horrible prison for no other crime than this, that he insisted that the Bible be the sole rule of faith and practice. in his life. He had no other object than to delineate all of spiritual life in his writings and to portray the mental conflicts and experimental holiness to which we are called. Now, I wanted to give you this. The writer, Josiah Conder, said of Bunyan, he thought in the very dialect of the Scriptures. Jack Seton, many years ago, we quoted him often, but many years ago, Jack Seton made the statement, "Dear old Bunyan, cut him anywhere and he bleeds the Bible." I think Jack pretty well nailed it there. Cut him anywhere, he bleeds the Bible. Josiah Conder said it this way. He said he even thought in the dialect of the Bible. We'll find out as we follow his biography, he had no other source. No other source. All Bunyan ever had, he was an uneducated man, and the only education, the only instruction he ever had was the English Bible. And he so buried himself in it, or buried, depending on where you're from, himself in it, that Conder said he thought in the very dialect of the Bible. To his thoughts, the Bible was the native scenery of his mind. What a beautiful way to put it. The native scenery of his mind. And that's where I wanted to just park there for a second today, and then we will close for today. I don't want to tire you. But the fact that Bunyan, and when you read Pilgrim's Progress and you read Holy War, you almost think you're reading the Bible, because he literally thought in the dialect of the Bible. It's the only language he knew. And it happens in Providence that I had put in my hands this week two different pieces of material. I had a book that I had ordered a long time ago, finally came this week on textual criticism, a brief primer on the subject of textual criticism. And Justin, we'll get this book and I'll go through it with you. And it deals with how to know what translations of the Bible, how these men who deal in the original texts, how they isolate and determine which of these texts. You understand that we don't have any of the original autographs, they're called. None of the original, the actual paper or parchment that Paul wrote on, or that whoever wrote them, Moses, we don't have any of those originals. All that we have are copies. And so these men, scholars, study these copies, and they classify them, and they identify them, and there are variations among them. No two, I found this is interesting. I read the book this week and finished it this week. I found it interesting that there are literally no two manuscripts in the world that are identical. No two. So there's variations. So textual criticism is the science in which they analyze all these and they determine what was in fact, what they believe was in fact the original writing, what was said originally and what was not. That's the business of textual criticism. So that opens up the whole. I read that book this week, and as well as that, Miss Dr. Suttles put in my hands her magazine that she gets from the classical teacher. In this particular month's version that was just put in my hands, there are two different articles on the subject of the King James Version of the Bible and its place in education. Now, this is fantastic. This is wonderful. I hope you get as much out of it as I did. Listen to this. I have always, when you raise the subject of what version of the Bible is the right one to use, okay? I've been all over the map on that subject over the years. Of course, I was raised on the King James Bible, and I came out of that, and I went into fundamentalist college, and it was, oh, bless God, if you don't have the King James Bible, you're going to hell. I mean, that's just it. There's no other to forget about it. God never said nothing. In fact, he wrote it originally in English. That's almost what they believe. Okay? And I was there. But then I moved along in some years, and this whole thing about textual criticism, and shock of all shocks, I found out God didn't write the Bible in English. And I said, oh my goodness, now we've got a problem. Now what? And so then you start looking at textual criticism. You start looking at, you know, the Textus Receptus versus the Byzantine and all these various things. And they're like, okay, well then maybe some of these translations. Okay, now I've got to figure out, okay, whoever translated the New International Version, what texts did they draw from versus the King James, etc., 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 etc. And so I went through a period of time where I said, okay, I mean, there's some good translations out there, probably as accurate as the King James. And in fact, technically, the Geneva, which preceded the King James, is more accurate than the King James. But anyway, I kind of backed off on that. And then, over the years, the pendulum swung back. And I came to the conviction, the very sincere conviction, that there is not a translation as accurate as the King James Bible. And so, although I'm not, what do they call them, Bible thumpers or whatever, I'm not one, I don't want to stand here and say to you that anybody doesn't have a King James Bible, probably not saved. That's ridiculous. But at the same time, I am very committed to the singular and sole use of the King James Bible. Now, that was my conviction before this week when I got this magazine. And I want you to understand that I had drawn that conviction from two things. I had always evaluated a translation of the Bible on the basis of two things. One, grammar, and two, canonicity. Canonicity means, does it belong in the canon of the Scriptures or not? So when these translators look at these manuscripts, I was looking for only two things. Accuracy of grammar. Is the English translation that I'm looking at the best reflection of the original words? Grammar. Secondly, canonicity. Is this text, does it belong in the canon of Scripture or not? Because as you know, some of our modern translations have whole sections that they've taken out. Because by the manuscripts they're studying, they don't believe they belong there. So the subject of canonicity becomes an issue. Just simply saying to you that prior to this week, my sole foundation for making a decision on a translation was grammar and canonicity. And from those two issues, I had settled firmly on the King James as being the right choice for English-speaking people. However, the writer of this article has introduced a third element that, in my opinion, is an incredibly powerful argument also for the sole use of the King James Version. And it is neither grammar nor canonicity, but it has to do with language and its effect on the mind. The writer says, I recently saw a debate between a Christian apologist, William Lane Craig, and an atheist, Christopher Hitchens. And I wondered why it was that Christopher Hitchens, the atheist, is always so much more compelling as a practitioner of English than his theistic opponents. How does he manage, despite the mistaken nature of his own belief system, how does he manage to sound so bloody good? The writer said. Why, by comparison, do his opponents seem so slow of speech? And now we know why Kitchens can talk circles around his debate opponents. he reads the Bible. Not just any Bible. He reads the King James Bible in particular, on which Hitchens shows forth his praise. In fact, this atheist paid it gushing homage in a recent article in Vanity Fair magazine, where he argues that the dignity of his prose, of its prose, the King James Bible, the beauty of its expression, and the appropriateness of its linguistic forms make it one of, if not the, greatest work in the English language. He says, this atheist, that it is the repository and edifice of language which towers above all its successors. My goodness. What a thing for an atheist to say. Oh, he was also thinking of our culture, that our culture is better for knowing it. Indeed, he says the huge influence of the King James Bible on English is difficult to measure. David Crystal, the author of Begat, the King James Bible, counts 257 common modern English expressions that are derived directly from the King James Bible. And he admits that he may have missed some. Is King James English still that prominent in the modern language and culture of our day? That's the question. Should we still have this in our day? Just take one expression, he says. Just one expression. My brother's keeper. Listen to this. My brother's keeper, with or without the word my, has named over a dozen episodes in television series. From such things as Knight Rider, Law and Order, ER, Tales from the Crypt. It was actually chosen as the first pilot episode for Miami Vice. A whole U.S. sitcom with this name was aired in 1998 and 99 on ABC. Perhaps more amazing, and someone that's as far as you can get from traditional biblical thinking, there's an American hardcore punk rock band called Brother's Keeper. All from one phrase in the King James Bible. Kitchen points out that the King James Bible not only does, but should inform our speech and thought. He says, and I'm quoting him, this atheist, a culture that does not possess this common store of imagery and allegory will be a perilous thin one. To seek restlessly to update it or make it, quote, relevant is to miss the point, like yearning for a hip-hop Shakespeare. Man, he says, is born under trouble as the start. Here's a verse out of the scripture. Listen to this verse out of the King James. Man is born under trouble as the sparks fly upward, says the book of Job. And this atheist says, want to try improving on that for Twitter? And so bleak and spare and fatalistic, almost non-religious, are the closing verses of the book of Ecclesiastes that were read at the Church of England funeral service of the unbeliever George Orwell. Listen to this. The atheist George Orwell, by his own instruction, had the final closing verses of the book of Ecclesiastes read at his funeral. He says, it is an unfortunate irony that as a prominent atheist comes forward to defend the King James Bible, so many Christians should be abandoning it. In his book, The Rise and Fall of the Bible, Timothy Beale has his own word picture of the plethora of modern Bible translations, referring to them as a distressed crop as when a tree is about to die and it puts off tons of seeds. That's what he says about modern translations. In the biblical strife of tongues, we call the modern Bible translations, there has been an attempt to be more, quote, understandable. And this attempt has taken the form of the systematic elimination of the living metaphors original to the text in favor of dead abstracts and technical speech. Many Protestants and Catholics have bought into the intellectually debilitating theory that bald prose is a better conduit for truth than living poetic expression. But man cannot live by rational prose alone. Hitchens calls this effort the rinsing out of prose. Hitchens, the atheist, again I'm quoting, when the Church of England effectively dropped King James in the 1960s and issued what would become the New English Bible, T.S. Eliot commented that the result was astonishing in its combination of the vulgar and trivial. This has been true of every other stilted, patronizing, literal-minded attempt to shift the translation's image from poetry to utilitarian prose. Utilitarian prose. That, our writer says, captures the whole problem. Only someone who has been linguistically inoculated against it by reading great literature such as the King James Bible would even be able to detect. To say that the best approach, now this is very convincing here, listen to this argument. To say that the best approach to truth is the direct route of bald prose not only goes against the approach of the original Bible writers who employed vivid imagery in their writings, but it also is an example of what Richard Weaver calls ideas in his book, Ideas Having Consequences, he calls it a quest for immediacy. The idea that truth must be approached like a conquering mental army, besieged and taken captive. But truth, he says, is mystery. It can only be approached indirectly. Modern Bible translations go after her straight away as an ox goes to the slaughter. And that's where we are today. At my father's funeral, says Hitchens, this is the atheist, at my father's funeral, I chose to read a similarly non-sermonizing part of the New Testament. This time, an injunction from St. Paul's epistle in Philippians. Listen to what the King James says. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And then the atheist says of this text, as much philosophical as spiritual, this passage was the labor of men who had wrought deeply with ideas and concepts. I now pluck down from my shelf the American Bible Society's commentary English version, which I picked up at an evangelical promise keepers rally on the Mall in Washington in 1997. Claiming to be faithful to the spirit of the King James translation, it keeps its promise in this way. Finally, my friends, keep your minds on whatsoever's true, pure, right, holy, friendly, and proper. Don't ever stop thinking about what's truly worthwhile and worthy of praise. And then he says, pancake flat. Suited perhaps to a basement meeting of an AA group these words could not hope to penetrate the torpid, resistant fog in the mind of a 16-year-old boy as those original ones did. Pancake flat. That's what he had to say. The translators of the 1611 wrote with a pen of iron and with a point of diamond. The modern translator writes with Word, published by Microsoft, and it shows. Both modern Protestant and Catholic translations suffer greatly from the misguided idea attempt to serve two masters. There are two selling points in modern translations, their readability and their accuracy. But any attempt at being understandable to the modern reader can become a threat to accuracy. At least if by accuracy we mean sticking to the original words. All this talk is vain oblation, Greek scholar N.T. Wright seems to suggest. Remarking on its lack of fidelity to the original Greek, he has called one of the most popular Protestant translations appalling. The favored modern Catholic translation is no better. Well, the problem seems to be, in his conclusion, he says, the problem seems to be that modern translators simply do not understand poetic expression, and hence, most of the Bible. Even in what's otherwise prose, most of the Bible is given in poetic expression. They are ill-suited to translate it. If they did understand poetic expression, they would not assume that non-metaphorical language is somehow more accurate or even understandable. Removing the poetry of the Bible, far from making it more understandable, does exactly the opposite. That's why good writers like C.S. Lewis use frequent metaphors, and so did Bunyan, I might add. People who write with clarity use more, not less, metaphors. Bunyan thought in the language of the King James Bible. Many modern translations are works of linguistic, I love this. He said the modern translations are works of linguistic taxidermy. Listen. They claim they can deliver to readers a Bible they can understand and assume that the readers can only understand dead language. Imagine a friend telling you that he has a real tiger at his house. And when you arrive at his house, you see it and he shows it to you and it's stuffed. And you say, but it's dead. And he says, yes, but it's real. And you say, well, it might be real, but it's dead. And he says, what's the difference? Maybe modern translations are real translations. I rather think they are paraphrases. But if they are real translations, then they're real dead ones. Stuffed and mounted for our hermeneutical convenience by scholars who don't know the difference between living and dead language. My goodness. I'm sure the translators of modern versions of the Bible, he said, are quite competent to know how to read Hebrew and Greek. It is their facility with English that I question. Well, he says more, and you can read it for yourself if you will. Let me just say to you, Bunyan, cut him anywhere, he bleeds the Bible. The King James Bible. And we, in our day, need not to forsake it, especially when even atheists understand its value. And one of the points that he goes on, you can read the article for yourself, I don't want to tire you, one of the points he makes is that language frames thought. Not just that thought frames language, but that language frames thought. And by abandoning the King James Bible, we have reduced the thinking of our children to sound bites and flat technicalities, and they no longer can think in the visionary way that God speaks to His people. Very significant. Very significant. I simply say to you, when Bunyan, our brother Josiah Conder says of Bunyan, he thought in the very dialect of the Scriptures. May God help us and help us to teach our children to think in this language. And it will not only enhance their vocabulary and their literary ability, it will in fact enhance their ability to think. Let's pray together.